The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hey there, this is The Takeaway for Friday, October 7th, 2016. Remember, you can join The Takeaway and me on Sunday for Debate Rewind live at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific time. We're going to be taking your calls on 800-543-2543. Now, this is your show. I want you to tell us what you think about the candidates and the debate, about the race, everything going forward. And we have a great guest, by the way, who's joining us. The show is about you, and I do want to hear from you. Again, Sunday live, 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific time. You can go to thetakeaway.org to find out where you can find us. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening.
If you're watching and you're in an evacuation area, get out. There are no excuses. You need to leave. Evacuate, evacuate, evacuate. Just think of all the people this storm has already killed. You and your family could be among these numbers if you don't take this seriously. Unfortunately, this is going to kill people.
That's Florida Governor Rick Scott urging the 1.5 million people in the evacuation zone to get out yesterday in preparation for Hurricane Matthew making its way north up the Atlantic coast. And that storm has been blamed for the death of hundreds of people already in Haiti. It's also delayed the presidential elections planned for the weekend in Haiti. We have more on that coming up in a minute. But Hurricane Matthew also presents a problem for U.S. elections, hitting just 1 month before and in the very swing state of Florida. Hillary Clinton's campaign had asked Governor Rick Scott to extend the state's voter registration deadline. That request was rejected by the governor. He said that people have had plenty of time to register. The Clinton campaign had initially also planned to run ads on the Weather Channel for the campaign during the storm, but decided to call back those ads amid some blowback. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's campaign is running out of time, and any pause in campaigning in Florida might hurt his chances. Kevin Kate has consulted with a number of politicians on how to walk that tightrope between respect and politics during natural disasters in all-important Florida. He worked on the Florida campaign of President Obama in 2008 and former Florida Governor Charlie Crist. He currently also consults for the mayor of Tallahassee. Kevin Kate spoke to our producer, Berkeley Wilson, and he says the preparations the state has taken in the 11 years since a major hurricane have resulted in a more prepared public.
I can tell you, for instance, last night, Florida Power and Light had upped their estimate to 2.5 million people possibly without power. And certainly the warnings that were out there, you know, through social media and traditional mediums were sterner than I've seen them in the past. I mean, everyone from Shepard Smith on the news to on the TV news to local elected officials to anchors in Jacksonville and Orlando. Newspapers doing what I think is a fantastic job with stern warnings that we will not risk the lives of first responders to come get you out if you choose not to evacuate. And I think that's really critical now in the aftermath. You really want to focus on how responsive not only elected officials are being, but the utilities are being to getting that power restored, because nobody really gives a look about politics when they don't have power.
I mean, the election is just weeks away. And Florida is obviously a very important state for both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. This is going to eat up the news cycle for a period of time. How is that going to affect the campaigns and their ground game in Florida?
Well, the ground game has to be paused right now, of course, and that happened a couple of days ago. And many of these campaigns locally and also the presidential campaign will pause their field programs and turn them into something of a charitable response effort to deliver ice, deliver water, make sure that people are taken care of in the aftermath as best they can. You know, the first priority is making sure these field staffers, many of whom come from out of state into Florida, are taken care of. So that's the first priority. But the show's called The Takeaway for a reason. So one of the big takeaways here is that, you know, with hundreds of thousands of people without power, with many paid political advertisements supposed to be running, these campaigns have essentially experienced a timeout for these days. And our Real Clear Politics average shows Secretary Clinton winning Florida by 2.3 points. So a timeout for Donald Trump. You know, he lives off of news cycles. He eats them for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, that's not good for him on the earned media side. And he just started ramping up his TV buys here recently. And certainly, I don't believe that having people unable to view those advertisements is a good thing for his campaign.
And so what would you advise both campaigns in terms of the aftermath of this storm? And it's only a 2-point race in Florida. So, I mean, how do you advise them going on from here?
Well, I think what you hope as a Floridian, number one, that they stay out of it because they're not an elected official while it's happening and in the direct immediate aftermath. But then following that, I hope that they are savvy enough to understand to direct their resources to things that are actually adding value and not distracting from the recovery effort. And that's everything from, you know, making sure that you have a human touch when you come and visit. Certainly, presidential candidates in the past, non-incumbents, have come and tried to make their mark after hurricanes. And that's okay as long as they're adding value to what's going on the ground here. And another, you know, super important point is that when people lose electricity, and I lived through this just recently a couple of weeks ago with Hurricane Hermine. I mean, I lost my own, you know, I lost power. I have three kids and a wife, and we the phone is the medium. You know, everybody charges their phone. They jump in their car and charge their phone. And so I think candidates should certainly be geo-targeting and being sensitive about the messages that they're putting out on social media to folks who are just scanning their phone to see if their neighbors are okay, if there's power lines down in the street. All politics is local, of course. We know that. And certainly all local news is hyper-local when it comes to storm recovery.
So Hurricane Matthew, one of the biggest threats has been the storm surge. There's been a lot of historical talk about climate change in Florida and how Florida is very susceptible to climate change, and a storm surge would certainly could potentially change people's minds on whether or not it's happening. Do you see that happening, Kevin?
You would think that that these catastrophes would make people more trustworthy of the science behind not only climate change, but also just hurricanes in general. But I don't know if you saw conservative leaders, if you want to call them, like Matt Drudge, being, I guess, I don't know if you call it a hurricane truther, but denying the science behind even the wind gusts and things like that. So it wouldn't shock me if there's a fringe of Donald Trump's campaign supporters that may not even believe this hurricane was here. I don't know what these people are thinking, but I certainly think there's an element of that. So I'm not crossing my fingers, hoping that any of Donald Trump's birther and truther supporters will acknowledge even the science of a hurricane, much less climate change.
That's Kevin Cate. He's founder of the PR firm CateCom and a political consultant in Florida, speaking with our own Berkeley Wilson. From Florida now, we head south to Haiti, where the death toll from Matthew is now in the hundreds. There are reports that the entire southern coast of that country of 11 million people has been completely devastated. Here's John Hassey. He's National Director of World Vision Haiti, speaking to us from Port-au-Prince earlier today.
Due to heavy flooding, World Vision anticipates spikes in waterborne diseases, especially cholera. Diseases that are spread by mosquitoes such as malaria, Zika, and dengue fever are also expected to increase dramatically. Because so many crops were destroyed, childhood malnutrition, which was already a significant problem in many of the most damaged areas, is also expected to increase.
Well, you just heard a minute ago how Matthew is affecting the presidential election in Florida, but in Haiti, that situation is even more severe. On Sunday, Haiti was supposed to have its presidential election, and that would have been a restart from the first round of elections in October that were dissolved because of charges of fraud. Now, because of Matthew, that vote has been postponed yet again, and a new date, of course, has not yet been announced as Haiti tries to begin recovering from this latest round of natural disaster devastation. Amy Willens has covered Haiti for decades. Her latest book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. It looks at the country's history and how it's moved forward since the devastating earthquake in 2010. Amy Willens, welcome.
Hi.
That earthquake in 2010, of course, killed 220,000 people at least, injured 300,000, 1.5 million people displaced, an awful disaster. Was there any increase in preparedness that came from that? Was there any increase in preparedness that has helped Haiti now with Matthew?
Well, as you know, preparedness for an earthquake and preparedness for something like a hurricane or a tornado are very different. You have a little bit of warning for the hurricane. You don't have warning for the earthquake, and Haiti was completely unprepared for the earthquake, even though it had a history of earthquakes, but I think most Haitians didn't even know that. Since the earthquake, there have been reasons to support the medical infrastructure in Haiti, and the reason to support it was the cholera epidemic. So there are more widespread clinics that can deal with cholera. Cholera came in after the earthquake with some UN soldiers who carried the disease but didn't show it. So in that sense, there's somewhat more widespread clinic care available. But in a situation like this, the clinics won't be able to get their supplies. The roads are all down. So I don't think even that's going to be that helpful. Otherwise, I think there's some heavy machinery, more heavy machinery available in Haiti than there was before. There may be more helicopters than there were before the earthquake. All of those are very important in getting supplies out to people in areas you can't reach on the ground.
And Amy Willens, we mentioned that the presidential election was supposed to be held in just a couple of days. That's on hold. What is the state of governance now with charges of fraud even heading into this election more than a month ago? Now that this devastating natural disaster has come through and they can't even hold elections, is there a political disaster waiting to happen, or is governance at least solid for the moment?
I think the political disaster is—it's not a single event. So the political disaster is an ongoing thing. You could say it began in the October election that was contested after it was held. Matthew is adding to the ongoing disaster by forcing the Electoral Council to delay the election, but I can only imagine that the Electoral Council is delighted to delay the election. You know, that just puts it off further, and it's been a chaotic electoral season and financed by huge amounts of money. The United States, I think, has put $33 million into this election. That hasn't really happened yet. And I think they're supposed to announce on Wednesday the new date for the election. So we'll see if they can get it together to do that. But it's a really scary thing to have a disaster like this with a so weak a government that, you know, you don't even know who to turn to. There is an interim president, but he's not elected and he has no mandate.
And devastating events like this can sometimes bring out the most cynical behavior in politicians of any stripe. Amy Willens, what is your most immediate hope now for Haiti, given, I mean, this is the immediate aftermath of the storm. We're still counting the dead and injured. You know the country so well. So what is your most urgent hope for the country at this moment?
I hope that the international community of helpers and relief workers and reconstruction workers will have learned from the earthquake to try and let Haitians take the lead in reconstructing the country. It's really, really important to give them your know-how and to help them with your money, but to let them make the choices. We see them already beginning to rebuild. It's amazing how Haitians stand up after something like this. And you can see in the video footage, if you look at it, people are taking away the ruins and starting to rebuild anew.
Amy Willens, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Amy Willens covers Haiti. Her latest book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2016 to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos for his resolute efforts to bring the country's more than 50-year-long civil war to an end.
That's Cassie Coleman-Fiva, chair of the Nobel Committee, announcing this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos. Now, awkward timing, to say the least, from the Nobel Committee here. It was just a few days ago that Colombian voters rejected the referendum that would have ratified the peace deal between the Colombian government and FARC rebels, ending the civil war there. Nonetheless, the prize is awarded, and after that defeat, President Santos and FARC leaders vowed to keep working toward a peace deal. And just today, negotiators for Colombia and the rebel movement in Cuba said they're taking steps to guarantee a lasting ceasefire, and they pledged to listen to those who voted against that peace deal. But Juan Manuel Santos is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Nadia Drost is in Bogota. She's a reporter there, and she's on assignment for PBS NewsHour. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Nadia.
Thanks for having me back on.
I mentioned some awkward timing. They have a short list for the Nobel Prize that I think is finalized sometime in February or March. So winners could have included aid workers in Syria or even Edward Snowden. Juan Manuel Santos is the winner, but that peace deal is far from settled now.
Absolutely. I think this is a shocker for Colombians, precisely because of the fact that the peace talks have become so derailed. There had been a suspicion beforehand that not only Juan Manuel Santos might be a winner, but that he might be a joint receiver of the Nobel Peace Prize along with the FARC leader Timoshenko. There was also speculation that victims who have been very much a part of the peace process in Cuba might be receiving the prize. So I think that there's not only a shock that Santos has won it, but that he is winning it alone, given that this was an effort on the part of multiple parties. I think that one of the things that Colombians are going to take away from this is that this is going to be seen as a huge push from the international community in support of the process and as a kind of push for all parties to try to resolve and salvage the remaining deal. However, considering that Santos doesn't have high popularity in Colombia, he's particularly suffering from that right now. I don't think that the Peace Prize is actually going to kind of elevate his standing here in Colombia in terms of your regular Joe's perception of him.
So maybe this increases the prospects for a final deal at some point, maybe not for Santos himself, even though he gets the prestige. Nadia, do Colombians have a national sense of irony at all? I mean, people standing around in Bogota or in the coffee shops, I know they drink a lot of coffee, saying, well, that's awkward, but kind of funny. We voted this thing down, the world knows, and then all of a sudden here's the award and at least get a chuckle out of it. If you're Colombian, how do you digest this?
And luckily, Colombians do have a very good sense of humor. And there is an expression here that when things start going very, very strange, a lot of people say it is Macondo. That's referring to a town in the books of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who wrote Magic Realism, where the extraordinary starts to become ordinary. And much of Colombian life has been characterized that way. So you certainly hear that a lot these days, that one day after another, there are rather Macondo events. But Colombians are used to this. And I think that this is going to be seen as just one irony after a long list of them.
Maybe just another page out of 100 years of solitude that you're referring to there.
Exactly.
So going forward now, if the Nobel Prize award increases pressure towards an eventual ratification of this deal, what's the timeline for renegotiation or the next time the Colombian people with their deep sense of Macondo get another crack at this?
That's what everyone's asking. We all want to know the timeline. There has been no timeline announced. There has been no announcement in regards of, you know, what aspects of the peace deal might be back on the table, which ones are absolutely, you know, not to be touched for rediscussion. However, both negotiating parties from the government and the FARC will be making an announcement out of Cuba this morning. They are back at the table. So that we might be getting some more news this morning, but so far we are still very much in the dark in terms of, is this renegotiation going to be, is it going to dissect the entire peace agreement? Is it going to touch, you know, just certain elements? And will it take a month or possibly 2 years?
Nadia, I've spent a little bit of time in Bogota myself. I'm going to venture to say Colombians would rather win the World Cup than have their president win the Nobel Peace Prize, but he's won it nonetheless. If it doesn't increase his political prospects, if he's unpopular, what does this mean for Colombian people in terms of their sense of national pride, or not much at all?
I don't think that it will necessarily affect Colombians' pride. I think that for a lot of Colombians that I've spoken to, at least, who voted for the peace accords, they feel that the international community is in a position right now to make fun of them, asking, you know, what country goes through half a century of war and then votes against peace. And so even though, you know, the gesture of a Nobel Peace Prize is very well intentioned towards trying to bolster efforts towards peace, I think that a lot of Colombians will see it as, you know, this is almost like a consolation prize, you know, saying pat on the back, Santos, you did a good job trying, nice try, but he didn't quite crack it. And hopefully, I think that Colombians will see this as a recognition that what is at stake here is not, you know, political calculations, but the end of a war.
And another page of Macondo, perhaps, right, Nadia?
Without a doubt.
Macondo in Colombia, magical realism. When things can't get any more strange, they just get more fantastical. Nadia Drost is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for PBS NewsHour, talking about all of the ironies of a long war in Colombia not voted down, and then a Nobel Peace Prize announced for President Juan Manuel Santos. Nadia Drost, thank you.
Thank you, Chad.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Thanks for ruining my vacation, Ripley.
Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
It just doesn't matter.
Are you two heading for Las Vegas?
Yeah, we're gonna score.
Boy, I sure wish I was going with you.
You got a helmet? Oh, I've got a helmet.
There are a whole bunch of big movie releases this weekend. Are you wondering what you should see or if you should even bother? I mean, it is the baseball playoffs, people. But some of you are movie people. River Guzman is film critic for Newsday. Of course, he talked with John Hockenberry about two of the week's biggest releases.
So we've got two big movies this weekend, that is for sure. Birth of a Nation, which is a remake of an incredibly controversial, legendary, I don't know what you'd call it.
Well, they've borrowed the title. I wouldn't call it a remake. Yeah. It's really, yeah, in some ways, I would call it a
correction.
A correction, exactly. Yeah. You know, this is the story of the slave rebellion by Nat Turner before the Civil War in Virginia.
Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers, to feed the church of God which he has purchased with his own blood.
Exhort servants to be obedient to their own masters, and to please them well in all things, not answering again.
You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men.
A lot of passion there, a lot of biblical references there. Does this work as a movie, or is it a sort of plodding historical depiction of a period of history?
No, it's an extremely powerful and obviously very brutal film. And that scene is where Nat, who was a preacher who was originally hired to go around the South calming angry slaves, sort of realizes what he's been doing and realizes what his role is and what he has to do, which is lead this uprising. Tragic film, very powerful, great characters, really well directed. You know, Nate Parker, kind of out of nowhere, an actor that people were dimly aware of, but suddenly he comes out as the star, director, and co-writer of this film. Hit of Sundance, strong Best Picture Oscar contender. It's a great movie, very worth seeing.
Unlike the original Birth of a Nation, controversy precedes this film, but it has nothing to do with the history and it has nothing to do with the depiction. It does have to do with the sort of background of Nate Parker. Does that affect anything?
Nate Parker was accused of rape as a college student, and the victim, the woman who accused him, later committed suicide, and that has been a real problem for this film. I don't feel like it's necessarily relevant to the viewing of the film. It didn't necessarily take me out of the film, even though we do see the aftermath of a couple of rapes in this film. I do wonder how much of a problem that will be for Nate Parker once the Oscar campaign season gets going and he's out there on the red carpet and trying to publicize this film.
When Barack Obama went on his Martha's Vineyard vacation, he took the book The Girl on the Train to read. Do you think he's going to see the movie?
I wonder. We all read that, sort of the scene as the follow-up to Gone Girl. Here's the movie with Emily Blunt. She plays an alcoholic woman who thinks she has seen a murder.
I saw her from the train. She was standing on the deck with this man.
Her husband, Scott Hipwell?
No, it wasn't him. This man was different, and they were kissing.
Wow, that's pretty coincidental, isn't it?
You just happen to be on a train at the same exact moment that a woman you don't know but somehow recognize is cheating on her husband?
I know it sounds crazy.
Neighbors saw a drunk woman in the vicinity of her house Friday night.
Is that Allison Janney?
That certainly is. She plays the detective, uttering my favorite line in this movie, "That's quite a coincidence, isn't it?" Which is a line I think you'll be repeating yourself throughout this film. I don't know what President Obama felt about the book. I felt it was nicely written, but pretty stupid. And I think in this movie, without that nice writing, there's nowhere to hide. And I think the characters, the coincidences, the sort of ridiculousness of the plot all come to the fore. And I found it to be a pretty preposterous and needlessly sexed up Hollywood thriller, I'm sorry to say.
Raver Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend and good luck, and have a wonderful time out there at the Hamptons Film Festival.
Yes, I'll be enjoying myself. You too, John.
Thank you.
It's a journey to the mountaintop of pop culture, a celebration for geeks everywhere. Comic-Con is upon us in New York City. A long weekend. It's jam-packed with panels and tributes to comic books, anime, movies, and, of course, TV shows. Our geek-in-chief is culture reporter Melissa Locker, and she was on the scene during the first day. She chatted up with Uber fans at Comic-Con, paying homage to their favorite characters.
I am Stealth.
Corpse Bride.
Undyne from Undertale.
I'm Akase.
I'm Yuno, TARDIS from Doctor Doom.
Melissa came in to talk to John Hockenberry about what panels are worth checking out at Comic-Con this year.
There is so much. The second that you walk into the Javits Center, which is the convention center where Comic-Con is held in New York, it is just this crowd of people wearing the most amazing costumes. On Thursday, when I was there, they were hosting their Doctor Who panel, which had some of the original characters, some of the most beloved doctors and companions. I saw an amazing woman dressed as the woman in the fireplace, which is a kind of obscure Doctor Who character. There were so many women dressed as the TARDIS. I saw little tiny kids dressed as Doctor Who. It was very much a Doctor Who fan show.
And that's a BBC property, but what about U.S. TV properties?
Walking Dead, they're going to be having a big panel coming up. The show ended on a series cliffhanger, and I think nobody knows what's going to happen next, and everybody is kind of on the edge of their seat to see what's going to go on.
And Wonder Woman turns 75. She doesn't look it.
I know. She's aged really well. It's the lasso of truth. Just keeps her young. She, you know, had a small part in the Batman versus Superman movie, and she kind of saved both of their behinds. And she's about to make her big push into the silver screen herself. And so they're doing a bunch of panels to kind of look back on her career. There was a lot of Wonder Woman fan art and comic books. And not as many people as you would think dressed as Wonder Woman, but maybe that'll happen tomorrow.
The Batman moment this year involves something that I know very, very well because I'm so old, and that's the TV show. Adam West, Julie Newmar. Right?
Mm-hmm. All of those people are going to actually be at Comic-Con to announce the new series and to sort of take you behind the scenes of the original show. And, I mean, Julie Newmar is just an absolute legend. And Adam West is too, sure.
What in Comic-Con is serious, did you find?
Well, I think there's actually a fair amount of serious topics. I think that the comic industry is starting to recognize that the world is becoming a more inclusive place, and they're trying to recognize that and reflect that in comic books and TV shows. So, like, Ta-Nehisi Coates took over Black Panther and has just kind of reclaimed that character as this incredibly powerful force for good. He's going to be talking to Steve Orlando about his kind of LGBTQ-friendly comic books as well. Two issues that just don't come up in comic books that often, which are race and gender.
Nostalgia is always big at Comic-Con. Before we go, aside from, you know, Adam West and Julie Newmar, what nostalgia can we look forward to?
This year, not only do you see Labyrinth, a lot of people dressed as Labyrinth characters, a lot of Labyrinth t-shirts. There's a panel on 80s movies, which I think is pretty funny to think that all these, you know, Comic-Con grown-ups are bringing their kids to introduce them to the wonders of the 80s.
You mean like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, those movies?
Yeah, Amy Heckerling and Martha Coolidge are going to be on a panel talking about like Brat Pack movies. And these are two female directors. No one quite compares to John Hughes, but they are definitely up there in the canon. And I think they're finally stepping into the spotlight.
Marvel dominates, but does DC Comics get their moment in the sun?
Yeah, I think DC Comics is always trying to kind of fight against the big guy. But one thing that they're trying to do is to appeal to a younger audience. So they gave My Chemical Romance's Gerard Way his own comic book and kind of let him do whatever the heck he wants. And that's going to be unveiled at Comic-Con this year.
Wouldn't it be great if they came to you and did the same thing?
Yeah, it would be kind of a weird mashup of like Stranger Things, but just the Eggo Waffle and My Little Pony and Doctor Who and I don't even know who else.
I'll think about that all week long. Melissa Locker, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So while Melissa Locker was inside the convention hall at Comic-Con, Takeaway producer Isabel Angel was outside talking to people about cosplay. Now, don't call it dress-up. Cosplay is a signature part of convention culture, where diehard fans try to become their favorite characters from the movies or a comic book. They often spend hours creating elaborate costumes. The more realistic, the better. But even in the world of geeks, acceptance has come late to some people.
My name's Tanisha. I'm from Philadelphia. I'm cosplaying as a rebel pilot from Star Wars The Force Awakens, specifically Poe Dameron. I've made a helmet and everything.
I'm Poe Dameron.
Good to meet you, Poe.
Good to meet you too, Finn.
My name is Tony. I'm cosplaying as Saitama, the One Punch Man.
My name is Alana.
My name is Christina.
I am cosplaying as Naruto Uzumaki.
And I'm cosplaying as Sasuke Uchiha.
I'm cosplaying as Wonder Woman.
And I'm cosplaying as Storm from X-Men.
Grim Dark Jade Harley. It's from a webcomic called Homestuck.
Cosplaying is almost like acting. You're trying to portray a character that you're familiar with or interested in or you like.
It's really fun to really actually get into the character that they're in, but also be yourself. Like, you can switch on and off.
It feels really powerful. It feels like I'm drawing from the essence of Wonder Woman.
I've always wanted to be a pilot. I figured I could cosplay as something that I'm not in real life and, you know, have a good time doing it.
I get to be who I always want to be, whether it's Static Shock or Green Lantern, and it feels good.
It makes me feel a lot more confident than my normal self because it makes me go a lot more outgoing.
The cosplay community is very unique.
People are very creative in this community, and they show that with what they wear and how they act.
There's a big range of cosplayers. There's always something for everybody. Everybody's always into something, and it's always fun to share what you like with other people.
It is amazing. I actually have friends from other cons that I still am in touch with. I have friends from like across the country because of cons. It's like amazing.
It's not a trend. It's not a fad. It's something you do or you don't.
My name is Hilton George. I am from Washington, D.C. I'm a cosplayer and a con organizer for BlurredCon, which is the term for black nerd. I have a kind of a corporate job, and there's not a whole lot of people in my world, my regular community, who really understand my geekdom. So this gives me a great outlet without having my parents call the paddy wagon on me or my neighbors calling the cops when I'm out playing around with my costumes and stuff.
Give me some Deadpool.
Well, I like to give ladies crisp high fives because they're so enthusiastic. I go from there and I just get to make all kinds of friends, most of them ladies. Guys, not interested. Hi, Tina, how you doing?
Hey, Hilton. Hello, my name is Viva Valentina. I go by Tina. I'm a cosplayer from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
I'm dressed as Psylocke from the X-Men. I'm half Filipino and half white. And growing up, you know, I've kind of had that mixed kid displacement and not really knowing where I belong. And in cosplay, it really allowed me to build my own wolf pack. But then also, there's those people that want to rain on people's parade. There are many, many times I've seen people body shame other people. And the number one rule about cosplay is you can cosplay whatever you want, regardless of your age, race, body type, you know, physical capability. And, you know, if you're trying to tell someone like, oh, you know, you're too fat to cosplay this character, your boobs aren't big enough to cosplay this character, there's no room for that.
Sometimes people want to draw these artificial lines and say, oh, because you're black, you cannot play a character that is overtly or openly white. For instance, a character which, like this, Deadpool, I kind of get a pass because you can't really see, you know, my race, and so it doesn't really play into this particular one. But if I wanted to be Superman, or if I wanted to be Aquaman, or if I wanted to play a character that is, you know, known to be a non-black character, there are some in the community who feel that, you know, you have to be so accurate and it's somehow doing a disservice to the character if you're not playing someone that you either look like or shape like or size like.
Nowadays, I feel like the community has come together to to speak out against those microaggressions and those phrases that really alienate other people in cosplay. And that's just been really encouraging, and to see that we're not okay with racism or sexism in the cosplay community, and there's no place for it, and it's getting better.
I think that cosplay and geekdom in general has been forced to be more accepting simply because it's growing so fast. If you have apprehensions, or if you feel a certain way, you can only do that for so long before you look around and you're like, you know what, I'm just going to have fun and stop being mad about nothing. And I think that's what's going to continue to happen until eventually everybody's going to be cool with everybody. We were talking about BlurredCon, which is for LGBTQ, people of color, underrepresented populations. And that's because there has been such a burgeoning of the Black Nerd experience, which you've probably heard of the geek experience, of the cosplay community. And I think it's going to be something we see more and more and more of.
As for more representation in comics, I mean, Iron Man is a Black woman now. The Hulk is Asian. Johnny Storm was a Black man. Things are changing. And I think as a culture and as society in general, not just geek society, we are getting more comfortable in changing up those race roles. And it's for the better. I love it.
Are you waiting to see a half Filipino, half white superhero out there?
All for it. Make Zatanna Filipino.
That was Hilton George and Viva Valentina talking with Takeaway producer Isabel Angel at Comic-Con in New York. Their convention, called BlurredCon, is a convention specifically for underrepresented groups, and it's happening next summer in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. In late 2012, struggling American journalist Theo Podnos slipped into Syria to report on that country's civil war, hoping to make a name for himself. Shortly afterward, he was kidnapped by Al-Qaeda captors who, because he spoke fluent Arabic, thought he worked for the CIA. For months on end, he was brutally tortured, eventually becoming a confidant of one Al-Qaeda top commander before he was finally released.
It was as if young men suddenly got a clubhouse in the neighborhood, and there's TV in the clubhouse, and there's tons of food, keys to Toyota Hilux and guns, and, you know, they had important prisoners to take care of and secrets and people to beat the shit out of and torture. I mean, the guys in Jabhat al-Nusra are having a great time, except that they get killed every once in a while.
That's Theo Podnos speaking in Theo Who Lived. That's a personal account of his physical and emotional journey at the hands of his Al-Qaeda captors and his transformation once he was let go to forgiveness, reconciliation, and an advocacy for the people in Syria. It's been a long road back for Theo Podnos since the day his trusted sources turned on him. Theo spoke with John Hockenberry earlier this week.
It was like dropping through the rabbit hole. I was through the looking glass. I was into deep Al-Qaeda land, and I thought they were about to kill me. So I was in like a state of suspended numbness, strangeness. I thought these are the last moments of my life. And, and I was trying to just take note of what the earth was like before I left it. That's what it was like right away, you know. And it remained that way for a long time, because their specialty is making you feel that you're about to meet God, and they want to prepare you for your encounter with Allah. So I was preparing myself.
What's it like to be in that state for so long?
I didn't have any books. I didn't have anything to like look at in my cell, no pictures, like barely a window. So I just conjured conversations in my brain, and I was lost. Sometimes I didn't know if it was day or night. And every time the door opened, my whole body shook, because sometimes they were bringing me food, but sometimes they're coming in with the torture stuff. So it's a horrifying situation. By the way, I'm fine now. I mean, I survived. I can play tennis. I run around. I'm happy. But what they did to me is going on every day across Syria. And it's in the interest of humanity to stop it.
Personally, in that situation, knowing that you were in the custody of Al-Qaeda, did you feel as though you brought this on yourself, that you were trying to...
I did bring it on myself. I submitted myself unknowingly to people who beat me and put me in handcuffs, tied up my legs, and delivered me to Al-Qaeda. I didn't have to go. Nobody put the gun to my head, said, go off to Syria and try to report. I did do it myself.
Did it make you think that journalism was a silly enterprise because you'd been so duped?
because nothing is worth the kind of suffering that they put you through. And what kind of illumination was I going to bring to the story? And how many people were going to read my New Republic articles? You know, I continue to think this. A human life is much more important than putting your head in front of a gun and allowing other people to pull the trigger. Many young men don't realize that that's what they're doing when they set off into the Islamic State or into any area that's under the control of the rebels right now. I mean,
what sense did you get of the people who were your captors? I mean, they gave you glimpses of.
Not only glimpses, I lived with these guys for 2 years. I mean, I know them well. I'm still in touch with them. They have families, moms, dads, wives. They have ambition. Some of them are talented. Some of them are backwards. Some of them are could have gone on and led happy lives but decided instead for the jihad.
How did it change from, you know, smacking you head against the wall to gradually having actual relationships with these people?
It wasn't anything I did, I believe. It was the fact that they at some point decided that they were going to deal me and not kill me. And so they wanted to basically rehabilitate me, bring me out from the worst and most horriblest conditions into something that was like livable and survivable. But it wasn't because I was charming or spoke Arabic or established a rapport. It wasn't that. It was a commander made a decision. And if he had made a decision, kill him or keep him until he starves to death, I would have starved to death or died with a bullet in my head.
Knowing as you do the conditions in Syria right now and the people who are living under those conditions, how hard is it to talk about your own torture?
Well, my torture is nothing compared to what they're living through. It's totally inconsequential. I survived. I'm happy. My future is a million times brighter. I have my whole life in front of me. A lot of people come out with injuries that that you can't recover from, and a lot of people are being killed.
What does torture erase from you in the moment that it's going on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess you just become a body. You're just this, you're screaming from a place within that you never knew it existed. The only thing you're thinking about is how can I make it stop? So I didn't want to live anymore. I mean, it took away my will to live.
Describe the moment you realized that it was over.
I cried. It took me a while to like realize I was safe, maybe 24 or 48 hours. Even when I got home to America after like maybe 3 or 4 days, I was still in a daze. I'm like, I was having dreams that I would wake up in the Islamic State with the guys all around me, and I didn't think it was real, but it has been, and it's been gorgeous, you know? I mean, I thank everybody that has met me and made my life better since I got out.
How do you keep from hating all of the people in Syria?
When I was there, I promised myself that I would never forgive them, not for what they did to me, but for what they were doing to my fellow prisoners who were getting it worse. Since then, I've become friends with these people on Facebook, and I chat with them, and I think the only way to peace is to forgive them, you know? Let them drop their weapons. Okay, that's a precondition, but after they drop their weapons, there's so many of them, we can't kill them all, and we got to make peace if we want a future for them and for us. We got to live with these guys. We got to make peace. So I think we got to forgive and forget.
What do you hope this movie does to individuals in the United States who see it and who have had enough of Syria and misery and have had enough of the Middle East?
I hope they pressure the U.S. government to engage in a constructive way on all sides of this conflict. At the moment, we refuse to talk to Party A, Party B, and Party C because we say, you people are so beyond the bounds of our moral framework that we find you repulsive in a moral sense. We won't talk to you. That puts us out of the game. It puts us on the sidelines. We have no skin in the game. We have no influence. We have no capacity to affect anything. So, you know, we've really washed our hands of the whole thing. And meanwhile, the slaughter is continuing. And we're giving the rebels guns and weapons that we would never tolerate on our streets. We're really, you know, counterproductive and dangerous influence in the conflict. Anyone who examines the situation closely and is in touch with all parties in the conflict and follows every day, you know, developments on the ground will come to the conclusions I've come to. And they won't think I'm naive or stupid or reactionary or anything. They'll just go, look, peace now and truth and reconciliation later. It's very important, this truth and reconciliation, but we can't have it until the parties stop murdering one another.
If in the future a child of yours decides, based on knowing about your life, to take similar risks, will you feel that you have failed to bring the kind of peace that you had really hoped to do?
Certainly, yeah. That's it. I mean, I was naive, and I was. There are many ways to be adventurous. You can be adventurous in a library, read an incredible diversity of books. You can be adventurous in, you know, in your daily life in a million different ways, and you don't need to do it by going and submitting yourself to Al-Qaeda warriors.
Theo Padnos is an American journalist and a former Syrian hostage. Thank you so much, Theo.
Thank you for having me.
That's Theo Padnos speaking with John Hockenberry there. The name of the documentary is Theo Who Lived. It premieres in theaters today. And if you want to hear more of this interview, you can find it on our website at thetakeaway.org. Well, the second presidential debate on Sunday. Hey, right afterward, you can join me and The Takeaway live at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Pacific. We're going to be taking your calls at 800-543-2543. This is your show to tell us what you think of the candidates, of the debates, and of the election going forward. Again, that's live at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific on 800-543-2543. And you can go to thetakeaway.org to find out where you can find us right after the debate. You can follow me on Twitter at Todd Zwillick. So have yourself a great weekend. We'll see you after the debate. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.